You are not alone. And now there are two resources that I've put together specifically for your journey. This is your host, Rachel Bernstein. I am an educator and a therapist and a cult specialist. And I am very excited to announce Restart and Restore, a journal for survivors of manipulation, and a companion notebook that I've put together to go with it that has people's stories that they've shared with me that they wanted to share with you, and some wonderful quotes from people whose thoughts I truly admire, and more pages and writing prompts for you to continue with the writing that can help you along your healing journey. This isn't just another blank journal. It's a trauma-informed recovery companion, and it offers psychoeducation on the mechanics of manipulation and control and therapeutic writing prompts to explore your history and your strengths, practical exercises that transform insights into some actionable steps, and the freedom to heal at your own pace. You can do it in the time frame that works for you without any judgment or pressure. Whether you joined the organization or the relationship that was controlling as a teen or as an adult, Restart and Restore provides the structure and, I think, validation needed to process your experiences safely. I'm also excited to share, beyond the journal and its companion notebook, that I'm currently working on a second journal specifically for those born and raised in high-control groups or high-control family units, as their healing journey often involves different and specialized challenges. Restart and Restore and its companion notebook are available now, and you can find the link in the show notes. Thank you very much. I hope it's helpful to you or to someone you love. Hi, everyone. I'm Rachel Bernstein from the Indoctrination Podcast, and I want to give you a quick heads up because I don't want you to miss something really special. Our next Patreon-exclusive Q&A is coming up on June 19th, and these sessions only happen every other month. Every time, the questions are so powerful, the conversations go deep, and the insights we share are things you won't hear anywhere else. If you've ever wanted to ask something about cults, something about your experience, something you've wanted to know that hasn't yet been answered out there, something you wanted to know about coercion, generally about manipulation, or the healing process after leaving a high-control group, this moment is for you. Question submissions end June 12th, so make sure your voice is part of it. Send your questions to indoctrinationshow@gmail.com and join us on Patreon so you don't miss out on this next Q&A. I'd really love to hear what's been on your mind. Take care.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Today on the show, we have Tia Levings back. It is so nice to be able to talk to her again and see how she's been doing and find out about all of the things that she is publishing. She's prolific and she is well-spoken, so you can tell that she's a great writer as well. Tia Levings is not only a writer, she's a creator and guest expert and content specialist who shines a light on the abuses of Christian fundamentalism and offers contextual insights into the realities of religious trauma. Her memoir, A Well-Trained Wife, My Escape from Christian Patriarchy, was released by St. Martin's Press on August 6th, 2024. Her social media videos have reached millions using her personal experience to connect entertainment, news headlines, and current events to the strategies and influence of fundamentalist ideology. Tia writes about religious trauma and Christian fundamentalism to educate, validate, and empower those who feel crushed by patriarchy, to create something beautiful from the pain. When she endured church-sanctioned violence, she felt very much alone, only to later discover that thousands of others had lived similar stories. Her message is clear. No one is alone in this, and no matter what a church condones or shelters, abuse is never acceptable. Her newest book is called I Belong to Me. And the description says that what does it mean to heal from trauma caused by the people, beliefs, and practices of your faith, and to rebuild a sense of self when high control religion said you shouldn't have one. Indoctrinated from early childhood to obey, conform, and want what others wanted for her only, Tia Levings learned love and acceptance meant being someone other than herself. After years of abuse in a violent marriage and high control religion, Tia Levings escaped with her children, a story told in her memoir, A Well-Trained Wife, and thought the hardest part of her life was behind her. But leaving was just the beginning. And with her audacious persistence to reclaim her life, Tia set off on a 15-year quest to find psychological peace. The result is an emotionally regulated, actualized, self-aware woman who is able to tell her harrowing story without re-traumatizing herself, which is very important. A woman also who can reach back to help others claim what's theirs. If trauma took your past, it shouldn't get to take your present and your future too. Through a series of personal stories, therapeutic stages, and resources, Tia Levings guides readers through the journey that helped her leave abuse, rediscover selfhood, and heal her mind, soul, and body after her religious trauma, so that you can too. It is my pleasure to have you hear my conversation with Tia Levings. Here's Tia now. It is a total delight to have Tia Levings back on the show. I was so excited to talk to you today. I'm so looking forward to our conversation. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. I was looking forward to it too. I was like, yes, this is going to be a good, easy hour and, well, 90, yeah.
However long. There'll be a lot to talk about, I'm sure. It was interesting when we first talked and I thought, oh, you know, I hear her. I hear the author in her when she talks. She has a wonderful way of speaking, of explaining things. And you're dealing with hard subjects, but you take your time to make it clear because it's really, I can't tell you how you feel, but it comes across like you really want people to get it, to understand, to also feel it, because that is the way that people, I think, can lean into it and take it seriously. And so I appreciate all of the detail, but also the feeling language that goes into it. And so I'd love for you to take a moment to introduce yourself or reintroduce yourself to people and talk about your new book, I Belong to Me, and all of it. And I hope people by now have gotten A Well-Trained Wife because, oh my goodness, yes, they have to. Go ahead, take a moment to introduce or reintroduce yourself.
Thank you for that. And thank you for noticing the patience that I apply to the story, because that's so intentional, but you never know how that's really going to land until you start hearing back from readers. So I am Tia Levings, and I wrote A Well-Trained Wife, My Escape from Christian Patriarchy. And that's my best-selling memoir of coming into a cult and escaping from it. It was a visceral escape because I had experienced something I call church-sanctioned domestic abuse, intimate partner violence that was kind of taught by our church and encouraged by our church. And so my extraction from that process was not just overcoming the domestic aspect of that, but also the role that my religion had played in it. So that came out in 2024. And almost immediately when I started talking about it in 2022, I started getting feedback from survivors online, people in the space, in the deconstruction space and ex-evangelical space, wondering how I had healed. How had I put myself back together after something that had been so harrowing? And A Well-Trained Wife does read like a harrowing, compelling, almost novel. I Belong to Me is the love letter to survivors that follows it up with what it was really like. And I'm not an academic. I'm not a therapist. I am somebody who, just as a layperson, went through this process with a lot of dogged determination. And I have a deep commitment to real talk and telling you what it's really like to go through something. So my self-help book is actually really different on the self-help shelf because it's not prescriptive and it's a layperson's take. So it's meant to be a warm conversation. It's very patient. It's very thorough. I have topics in there that aren't in any other books. It's a strange, weird, surprising journey to healing. And I'm very grateful that I got to write the whole experience. My publisher has been very gracious in recognizing that we are at this pivotal time as a society where we have this big ex-evangelical movement and this big religious trauma awareness, but we are also sitting on the cusp of a tidal wave of people leaving cults, leaving MAGA, leaving high control environments and relationships. And so, you know, it's our hope that we have more books on the shelf as a resource for people leaving, because 20 years ago when I escaped, which I cannot believe it's almost 20 years now, I didn't have very much on the shelf. We hardly had language for this stuff. It was very daunting to try to explain to someone what had happened to me when there wasn't even a lot of therapeutic language available for it. So that's the bulk of my work. Most of people meet me online today where I educate on the everyday abuses of Christian fundamentalism and the influences in our culture. So I am really tied into the timeliness of this movement and this situation that we're in. But I'm also, you pegged it, I am a author at heart and was writing before I started my memoir. I will continue writing after I do this foray into nonfiction because there's a big life ahead and I'm healed enough to meet that. So I really want to turn around and hand that kind of hope to people who might not feel like they have any. It is particularly painful when the source of your pain is tied to the source of your comfort and you have to extrapolate what your faith situation looks like. And I just hope that I'm one voice of many to help others navigate that.
Well, okay. So as you were talking, I was thinking, oh yeah, I want to talk about that. Oh yeah, I also want to talk about, oh, I want to come back. Okay. But I will start with this idea that just even the title, I Belong to Me, and then you talking about how in your self-help book, it doesn't fit a formula. If you do belong to you, I think then inherently you can't follow a formula.
Exactly.
A lot of it is, I'm sure, going to be trial and error, figuring out what does work. Something might work at a certain time and not at another time. Maybe it was too soon or it was too late or whatever else. There is a book that I'm putting together. I hope it's out, I think, in February, where each chapter is a case that I worked on. And I thought, okay, this is going to take me some time because each situation I worked with the people in very different ways. Of course, I have my idea about what I think is sort of right and wrong. I'm never going to do attack therapy. I'm never going to do the things that some people do, like challenging someone until they break, whatever else that people learn in cults. And so there are a lot of times I learned things in school and I remember thinking to myself, no.
No.
And so each situation is different, is unique. And I love that you're able to point that out. It doesn't mean you're doing it wrong. It means you're doing it your way. And that also means doing something that you probably didn't have a chance to do, which is checking in with yourself to see, is it working? Does it feel right? Is this helping? And I'm the only one who can decide that. So that's very empowering. I'd love for you to talk about that process.
As listening to you, my younger self just felt hugged and acknowledged and validated. Body awareness is so important to me as a litmus of where I should go and what I should do or how quickly I should do it. Pace is really important to me. And you're right, I was denied that. And a lot of people in an indoctrination situation are denied that. Because the service to the ideology is more important than the individual's ability to hold it. So as an intuitive, pretty sharp kid, felt betrayed very young at being forced to go along with things that I wasn't really ready for, or I didn't understand, or just completely overwhelmed me. And so those are words I can say without using a language like trauma for it, but it does translate to trauma in my psyche that way. So the title, I Belong to Me, was just so reflective and is such a rebellion against the message that they told me my whole life was I would have no sense of belonging unless I belonged to this group. I had to have this group for safety and identity. I had to believe the way they believed in order to stay, you know, and in A Well-Trained Wife, I get into what that actually looked like. I was formally excommunicated from the final cult that I was in, but I also still really believed and embodied that I needed to have some sort of church community in order to have a sense of belonging. You know, it's such an ordinary thing that we're told and we assume. And somewhere in my journey, around, I don't know, 8 years in, I heard the phrase self-sovereignty. And I didn't even use it in my book because it's still provocative to me. I still struggle with the idea that a being, an individual would be sovereign unto themselves and like the final say of what happens and comes in and what they participate in. But I sat with that and realized that I was my healthiest when I knew I do belong to myself. I am fine on my own. I don't find safety in groups that manipulate through belief. And so reclaiming that for myself of like, no, actually, I belong to myself. And anyone who has a problem with that is probably fraught with red flags. So the book is full of mantras. It's full of questions and it's full of mantras. And that's the top one in direct opposition to that idea that I need to belong to someone else in order to be safe, valid, healed, whole, loved, wanted.
Right. And I want to come back to the idea of mantras. The idea that you just said that you thought you had to be a part of the group for your safety and identity. Now, as you hear yourself say that, you realize how far it was from that, but that there's still so many people who are adherents who stay with something because they think it is what's going to keep them safe. And they might not be wanting to take the risk or ready to take the risk to find out that they're going to be much safer outside. It's a huge leap. It's a leap of faith in yourself to leap, right? And so I just wonder about that whole process.
I haven't really talked about this in the book, but I have in interviews. Like, it's almost like a graduate level of belonging. It's not where you start. It's so scary to be out on your own, to jump into the unknown. You can't do it from a fresh deconstruction, a fresh awareness that you need to get out of a situation. We're not cavemen, you know, that's where that primal tribal urge comes, you know, to be in a group for survival. And I think it's an antiquated idea that we don't challenge enough. I hear it reflected in so many people who are grappling with their faith. They're afraid to leave their church groups. They're afraid to leave groups that they've had an identity with and they find a commonality with. And it delays their psychology. It delays their journey because they don't want to let go. So I didn't start there. That was good, you know, 7-8 years into it. And so one of the things I hoped to capture in Belong is like this scope and sequence, like this spiral method of you start small, you start with identifying what happened to you and learning to name it. And then later you get to a place where you're not lonely with self-belonging. You enjoy your company. You've reclaimed some of your self-worth. That's what it was for me as taught to me by therapists. That's not something that I came up with. That's something therapists taught me. So that's what the reflection of the journey, which I'm sure you can speak much more to because you are the actual therapist that teaches people these things.
Right. There are a lot of people who they're like on this cusp, and sometimes then they will come to me and probably people who reach out to you. You're giving me strength. You're giving me hope. I'm thinking about leaving or I'm on my way or I'm trying to gather and garner the confidence and bravery. And I hope that it is better on the other side. I haven't found yet in my 35 years of doing this that someone regretted leaving.
Oh, I love that. That's profound.
I was thinking about that because I think about you now saying, you know, that you belong to yourself and you talk about the leaving process and reclaiming and that leaving is just the beginning. And I've heard people say they miss certain things, but not that they regret leaving. That's very acceptable and expected that you're going to miss things. And even if what you miss is real or what you miss is what was imagined there that existed there, still you can have a sense of loss. but still know that you now get to have a life and you are now finding out who you are and seeing your strengths and enjoying the world and able to feel happiness, kind of enjoying if you still have a religious process, whether you believe that things were created by God or not or whatever else, that you have a chance to appreciate what was created, that you're not just in survival mode, because you can't stop and smell the roses when you're just trying to make it through the next 20 minutes.
Exactly. Yeah. It's so closely tied to grief work. I have a chapter in the book on grieving. When I miss something, I am grieving it. It's not for me anymore, but I still loved it. I still feel nostalgia for it. But it's so wonderful to have it integrated and metabolized to a point where I can look at it and appreciate the good from it without feeling victimized by maybe being left out from it or having that loss from it. It happened just today. My old youth pastor posted a video of our youth group singing. We had this like 500 strong youth choir and orchestra, and he was very well loved. And I'm still like Facebook friends with him, but I'm closed out of most of the alumni groups and the nostalgia groups. I'm somebody who told. I told on our church. I told. So I'm exiled. But I saw it and I was like watching the posts go down, and that feeling of being left out and othered and exiled was starting to hurt. And I was like, it's okay to feel sad about that. You loved them and you would love it if they took your story seriously. And that's okay to acknowledge. And then I moved on because it's got perspective in my life now.
Yes, right. And to go to the mantras that you talk about, because I think there are a lot that are floating around in the New Age, in a lot of places in religious environments, they have their own mantras. I'm going to assume that yours are crafted for you by you. That would go along with Tia, and how, yeah. Right? How she operates.
Right.
And so I'm just wondering, not that you have to give away everything in the book, certainly, but maybe just pick one or two that you can talk about to us today.
So you're referring to the I statements. They're at the top of every chapter. Every chapter is like a question, like, is sex always this way? Or will it always hurt like this? What happens if I get in trouble? That's an interesting about that question. We had some talk at the editorial level of, do adults use that language? And I was like, every survivor I know is worried they're going to get in trouble with somebody if they tell the truth. It has to be phrased that way. And then there's the corresponding answer that I came to in my journey of, no, actually, I take all the time that I need. I resist the life of urgency. I clean up my messes. These are the I statements that I formed as I healed my self-identity. So it's very parallel to my journey from indoctrination to self. It's a sense of self that I had to grow and develop because I didn't use I statements in the beginning. I always pointed to my system or my faith or God or family or who I was blaming for something. And it took a real growth to get to a place where I could not only hold an I statement and say it, but I could sit with it and not feel afraid of all the feelings that came up. It can feel vulnerable to take an I statement. You are going to often face some responsibility or action step in relation to it. So if you say, I clean up my own messes, there's things you're going to do that cleaning. You're also admitting to some complicity and to some responsibility in a situation. And I didn't have the bandwidth for that or the window of tolerance, the space in my margins to sit with that discomfort in the beginning. I had to grow into it. So it's all such a journey. I know I wrote the book so that people can pop into it wherever they want to on whatever topic. Also, it's scope. It's a journey. It's a path forward. And one thing I hope that really comes through is that if you skip to the back of the book and you're a baby, you might not be ready for what's back there yet. You might need to back up and go to the beginning. And like, are you still in shock? Are you still really activated by your triggers? I was too. Here's how I worked through that. It is just very relational and patient that way.
Yeah, skipping to the end. I mean, there are some reasons that people are going to want to find out what they're about to get into. I was talking to someone who said, we agreed that we're not going to read a book or see a movie if the animal dies. Like, there's some things, if it gets shot or something, they're suffering, whatever, or if a child, there are some things that are beyond what we can handle. And I've been known to read ahead. But what I think is interesting is just making I statements and how revolutionary it can be, how bold it is to just say the word I and to know that there is an I and that you matter. Because that's also, I think, for people who don't realize how that was never on the table as something that was going to matter. And in fact, it was pride and it was a lot of bad things if you mattered. So here you get to say, I, and this is something that people take for granted who are raised in environments where they get to say that. There's some places where people can't. There's some countries where people can't, where women can't. It's not about them at all. And they're invisible, literally invisible in a lot of cultures. But I think that there is something so wonderful about being able to say, I and I matter, and my opinion matters, and what's best for me matters. But that it doesn't mean you are selfish. You don't have to apply that formula anymore, which I'm sure is very freeing, although I don't know if you believed it right away.
No, it was definitely a process. And it was baby steps of acclimation. I'm a big believer in letting myself acclimate to each step. Even happy things. My books got here a week ago. They sat in boxes in my living room for a week because I needed to feel, oh, they're here. The books have arrived. They exist and they arrive. And I don't want to rush through that stage and just rip them open and blew past it. I do that for positive and negative things because of lessons like that, where I had to first sit with the word selfish. Who benefits when I have no self? Who benefits when I never take time for myself, or when I'm using the joy model, Jesus, others, you, and it's never your turn because there's always someone else you can put first? Really dealing with the fruit of the teachings that I had been under and that I wasn't preserved, I wasn't thriving. And so if my annihilation was the goal, they were succeeding. But if my success was the goal, they were failing. And what was I going to do about it? It was kind of parallel to Mary Oliver's poem. It's very almost cliche at this point, but what is it you'll do with your one wild and precious life? I mean, we really have one. And if we are going to give it all away in service to the end of ourselves, that's a choice. But I didn't want to die for that service anymore. I didn't want to die for that system. It wasn't benefiting my descendants. It wasn't benefiting my relationships. So I had a very tangible reason to want to change. And I knew it was going to have to start with me. And that meant I was going to have to sit in some uncomfortable territory. So yeah, I statements, I mean, I did them shyly and at home in my locked room, in my journal, in safe places. I was in charge of who saw what when. You know, this is a 15-year journey that I belong to me encapsulates. It wasn't all at once. You know, it was definitely a growth curve.
I'm glad that you're mentioning that there were these steps that you needed to take to just get used to saying things, and that you said them privately, maybe even whispered, just even said them in your head. And right, so there are all these steps that you take where you can become more courageous and not as fearful. But by the time someone makes a statement like that, it usually is that they have needed to go through a lot of just breathing, talking themselves through it. And all of these moves are really very monumental.
Mm-hmm. They were.
It's incredible. Also, going back to what you were saying about getting into trouble. So let's talk about that. I'm glad that you preserved the word trouble, because you want to use the language that was the anvil over your head, right? Getting into trouble, being treated like an acting out child. So I think it's very appropriate to hold on to the language that made you feel you were being treated in that way or made you be seen in that way. I think that is powerful. And I wonder now about making mistakes or getting into trouble and how different it feels now.
Yeah, it's a little both and. So those younger parts that were punished often violently for making mistakes or having my motives thought the worst of, very often I was vilified for trying hard, being good. I was a good girl. I was a kind person. But I would make mistakes and then I would be punished for them by people who wanted to control me, or they didn't want that kind of behavior, or neurodiversity that was too much in a room, too loud, too much talking, too much of all the things. And so they're always there when that happens. We just had in a situation last week. So this is a great example because I'm in my selfhood, and that doesn't mean I'm free from old messaging and impact. I just know how to process it and I have tools in place now when I do encounter it. And I had a situation where I responded very quickly and swiftly and impulsively, but with kindness to someone. and I expressed condolences for something, just kindly. It made them angry because they didn't want me to know this information. I became their antagonist, even though I had been kind. So I was in trouble with them. And my younger part was inside of me quaking, like, are we going to get in trouble? Are we going to get punished now? Me and my self-power was like, no, we have done the right thing. This is about them. I can see where the boundaries are now. I can see that's their problem. I did my part. I did not harm anything or anyone or mean any harm. There was no actual harm done. He can call me his antagonist all he wants, but that doesn't make me so. So I was able to distance myself from it, which that emotional distance is the thing that was lacking for most of my life, where I was internalizing every message and I was taking their word as gospel every time. They'd get mad at me, they'd offer their narrative, and I would agree. It must be that. I must have hidden sin in my heart. I must have had an ulterior motive. I must have just been walking sin, embodied sin myself. It's like they talk to women and girls in high control religion, is your very nature is at fault here. And I don't believe any of that anymore. So I looked at my behavior, and my behavior was kind. My behavior did not intend harm. And that reaction is his to deal with. And so, yes, it was like this caretaking of younger me, but it was also psychologically evolved me being able to say where the boundaries were. And then I was able to walk forward. That's the gift that I want to help encourage people to realize they too can have. Because when you're stuck in the in trouble fear, you're trapped. You don't know how you can get out of that. You don't know how you can break a cycle. And then that behavioral aspect dictates our behavior. It sends us to therapy. It's why can't I get through this? Why do I keep repeating the cycle? That doesn't get you out of the work of it. You still have to do the work. But if you know that there's a possibility on the other side, which is not something I had when I left in 2007, I didn't have a lot of voices saying, if you go down this journey, you will have wholeness on the other side and you'll be able to look back and see how you've grown. I had to kind of trust I was going to find that. We're not there anymore. Now there's examples of survivors who have come out on the other side so that new exiles can say, oh, there's a way through this. I just need to trust myself and do this work and it will pay off, which I think is a completely different thing than when you're alone and dropped on your ass and you have to figure it out and you don't even know if this is going to work.
Mm-hmm. Dropped on your ass. I love it. Dropped on your ass, dropped on your head, just dropped. Just, yeah, it's a thud. The other thing that I've talked to a lot of people about, and probably noticed this too, I'm assuming that when you make a mistake or when you're getting busted for something, it doesn't have the same gravity. It doesn't stay with you for as long. It doesn't mean something about your character. It isn't this death sentence of your reputation forever, like it would be in a group that is watching and monitoring and pouncing to judge all the time, and to have it be, this is now our vision of you. The stress of that, and I know people not raised in religious environments or fundamentalist environments, raised in family systems where they're the clumsy ones because they dropped something when they were four or whatever else, and that's now their moniker forever. And just knowing that you have to deal with that. And when you leave that, you get to say, oh, sorry, or my bad, or oh, whoops. And there's room made for that. And people still see you as a good, reliable person. And that probably took some getting used to.
It did. I internalized shame so easily. I was a sense aware. That's my way to reframe sensitive. Sense aware child.
I like that. Sense aware instead of sensitive. Yes. I really want to make sure people heard that. That is so important.
Ooh. It is so important. My awareness is very heightened and I'm observant. I'm very close observer of people and character and actions. This was something that's with me always since I was a very young child. So I picked up on signals and intuition and the neuroception and all of that. And I would take the teaching, the overt teaching they gave me, and that was always to take it into your heart. And so I was internalizing those messages. And then in recovery, I would hear people say, you have to let go of shame without actionable, practical steps on how to do that. So that was a breaking point for me. I was like, I understand your abstract encouragement here that I need to stop embodying shame, but I don't really know how to do that. I need a cookbook. So I Belong to Me is a bit of a cookbook, and a lot of it is in language reframing. And so not internalizing that and realizing that this is inside of me and that's outside of me was so powerful, but so unfamiliar. And you're right, it did take me a long time, and I still encounter it, of just knowing how to name it, knowing how to observe it, knowing what's for me and what's not for me. That already, just saying that, it can exist over there, but it doesn't mean it's for me, already takes the shame out of the picture. There's no shame. If other people can have what they want, to each their own, that's not for me. I don't feel ashamed that it's not for me. I know evidence-based that it's not for me, and experience-based. And so I feel freer, but freedom is bright healing and sometimes stings and takes time to get used to. And then it also doesn't come without responsibility. So that accountability and awareness of, all right, you want to be a big girl and be free, that comes with some weight, but I have the capacity for it. So reclaiming those parts of myself that were a lot. Yeah, she's a lot. That means she can hold a lot. I produce a lot. I do a lot. It's a direct reclamation of when I was shamed for being too much as a small child.
Shame for being too much is something that really smarts, that really stays with you for a long time, and you diminish yourself thinking that's going to make it easier for everyone else to tolerate you. Oof,
make yourself small, hand over your superpowers. They don't even have to do it to you because you'll do it to yourself. I had to stop being my own worst enemy. And when I did, I found, oh, actually, the consequences that they tied to it didn't always manifest was one, but also I started to grow, which was I could see then, oh, that's why they want me small. They don't want to have to make space for me. It makes them uncomfortable to have to make space for someone. They don't feel adequate when they see someone else outperforming, or they feel threatened by my superpower. So started to change, like, okay, why is this done? And knowing why something is done is pretty powerful. That helps you really see through the brick walls. Like, you've got x-ray vision when you can see why people do what they do.
Mm-hmm. I heard a quote recently by Bette Midler, actually, who said that the only problem with becoming successful is that it's harder to find people who are happy for you.
Oh, ouch.
Right? Because you impact other people just by virtue of what you are doing and being. You're not trying to make them feel that way, but then they do. And then you kind of pay a price for it. And that's a really unfair burden, especially for a child.
That's a really great point. And that brings to mind, I'm sure you see this in your experiences, where parents are kind of competitive with their children, or they feel threatened by their children. And so that gets into the relationship of projection and all kinds of things. Like, yeah, I can definitely see where that's a thing.
Yeah, oh, most definitely. All my kids are good at math, which skipped over me.
Me too.
My youngest in third grade asked me to help her with her homework, and I took a look at it and I just said, I'm out. I think that was my limit. I'm happy to go watch some YouTube videos. I'm happy to take a course and to help you, but I can help you emotionally. I can sit here and while you do this work that I don't understand anymore. But I was very happy for her that she had the skill she was going to be able to take into the world. It's an interesting thing there. I think there's some people who see things as a pie chart, like things are finite. Like, if she has this, then I have less. Or no, it's just limitless. I'm just interested in other things or feel a competency in other things. Okay. But that is not the way a lot of people are in the world.
No, especially not in the religious traditions we're talking about, where it's not an expansive view of God. So it's not an expansive view of humanity. They have a very static, I even heard Ali Beth Stuckey like defend her Calvinist version of God as a very static creature of the ancient world. Well, I outgrew that God a long time ago. Like, I remember being in that world and thinking, if we can have an answer for everything about God, then he's not so big. That just was not inspiring to me at all. But as I healed, my imagination about the divine actually expanded, and so did my love for humanity and my space for the strengths everybody brings to the table. I'm so glad that there are people who are good at the things that I'm not. I don't feel threatened by that. I feel relieved. Like, I want to celebrate it. Yeah, it changed everything inside.
Yeah, I think going back to this idea of language and changing the way we talk about things, I'm reminded, and I don't know if we talked about this last time, but I've been watching these videos on Instagram, TikTok, people who are linguists, people who study antiquities and ancient languages and other things. And there is a man who has these videos, and I've talked about them on the podcast in the past, where he is able to retranslate a lot of biblical passages so that it has the original meaning. He studies cuneiform and other, you know, really ancient
languages. Wow, amazing.
And it has been really revelatory. The idea that Eve came from Adam's rib is actually a mistranslation. The word rib was not the one that was used. That's how it was translated, so that it was kind of an insignificant part. But it really, the word means side. So they were side by side.
Ugh. That's pretty crucial to the interpretation of that story.
Pretty crucial. And same thing with virgin, that Mary was not a virgin. The original word is young woman, but it got translated to virgin. And so it blows your mind when you look at how things were retranslated, mistranslated, or purposefully mistranslated because it was going to help maintain the system as they wanted it to be maintained.
I address this a little bit in the book through story wounds, because story is used to manipulate, to translate, to coerce, to offer this narrative in high control religion. But then we also build stories. And I was very captive by the stories that I was telling over and over in my head without challenging them, without questioning them, without even knowing how to do that. And then also like the story that I tell about my life and as I go forward and as a writer, that's so crucial to me, feeling like I didn't have a right to my own story or I needed to have permission to tell my story. I think story wounds is just one of those examples where we carry injuries as survivors of religious trauma, but it's not really addressed or acknowledged. And so it's one of those examples of like something in my book that I know is really different because I just haven't seen that. I haven't seen people really talk about the way that we're injured through that. Yet we carry those wounds with us. And when we carry those wounds, it will keep us silent. It will make us depend on a translation or a tradition that we, again, have never challenged. I'm so glad we live in a time. This is one of my favorite things about the internet is a story just like that, where somebody comes in with an expertise that we never had access to before. And it blows the lid on a lifetime of translation, a lifetime of understanding the rib story. Like, what? I mean, I thought it was kind of groundbreaking once we realized that men and women didn't have different numbers of ribs. Like, that alone was a... And now it's not even rib. I mean, wow. It's amazing.
It's helpful because then the next time you're told that something is this way or this is the way to look at it or this is the truth, well, okay. Well, maybe not.
Maybe not.
Mm-hmm. Some people have an easier time than others, though, with that kind of openness.
Oh, for sure.
The maybe not.
When you bring shame, yeah, hell, inner fundamentalism, there's so many reasons why they have the problem. I take the problem itself and say, okay, look at that. That's where you should spend some time. Why is that a catch for you? When I have a catch, you know, I'm on the phone with my therapist immediately. I'm digging through research or I'm getting books or I'm finding out what that catch is and why do I feel it. I might be right, but I need to know what it is in order to, because it's stopping me from something, or it's usually if something comes up and catches me like that, there's emotions tied to it and my emotions will influence my behavior, which is one of my primary drivers. I wanted to behave like a different person. I wanted to move through the world as a free person. So that means I can't let myself be caught up by catches. I got to know what they are and investigate them. So. Yeah, it's not a replacement for therapy. It's like therapy is an important tool to like, who are you without that? What if you didn't have that catch? Who would you be? What does that mean? Like, if you suddenly don't believe the Bible's inerrant, what does that make you? And how do you feel about that? And that can be scary as fuck. I don't know if I'm allowed to cuss on your show, but
you are most definitely.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I support people doing that here, especially because this is so much about freedom and expressing yourself in a
right.
way that you couldn't
good.
Before. So.
Yeah, yeah, it's an empowering form of language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, it really is. And sometimes it's just right. It just feels just right.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the most versatile words in the language, too. Fuck can be a verb, an adjective, an expletive. Yeah, there's just so many things you can do with it.
Oh, and I've heard about, what is the term? Fuckery.
That's fuckery, yeah, yeah, I love fuckery. Yeah. Yeah.
Right, yes. I don't often say shit, but I like the way it said people from Ireland where they say shite. Very fancy.
Yes. I agree.
A shit with an accent. Anyway, back to I would love actually to discuss forgiveness with you, because it is something that a lot of people I work with grapple with. And it's something that comes up a lot. There was a talk that I was giving years ago at a conference for the National Association of Social Workers. And my subject was why people sort of say yes when they really wanted to say no, and why people stay in situations for a long time. And even though that is what they really wanted me to delve into, at the end, spoiler alert, at the end, I talk about how it's not really the right question to ask, why did you stay? But it's what was wrong with the person or the system that caused you to feel like you couldn't leave? Let's put the focus elsewhere, not on the victim. But one of the things that I talked about was sort of how to heal from situations where you felt that you were mistreated, et cetera. And there were a number of people there who were religiously based. It was in the South. They were very tied in with their religious tradition in this space where I was working and talking. And this number of women raised their hand during Q&A, women who were social workers and big in their field. And they kind of admonished me for not bringing up forgiveness as a manner of healing. It would not have occurred to me to bring up forgiveness, but that they said in their situations, two of them were open about the fact that they had been abused by people within their church, or one was a choral leader, another one was a pastor. And when they went to people in the church, they were told to forgive and that it helped them put it away. And I said, okay, that's not going to be on my to-do list for anyone. And they said, no, but it's so helpful. And I said, but it's so unclear. And you mentioned clarity before. Because then you don't really know what happened and who's responsible for what and whom. And I said, I could imagine saying that you forgive someone, but maybe only after the other person acknowledges what they did or apologizes or promises never to do it again or something. I think forgiveness is based on merit, not just that you're forced to. Because I said, what happened to the choral director? Nothing. What happened to the pastor? Nothing. So I said, so you're the one who were given an action step. You needed to do something for them. They said, no, it was for us. We had to do it. This is how we relieved ourselves. And I said, okay. I didn't want to argue because here, this was at the end of a long afternoon, but I could see how much it was ingrained. And so I'm just wondering about that and how that plays out now. Like if that was something you were taught growing up that you needed to do if someone harmed you, and now what you do differently.
Yeah, I have such a complicated, unsurprisingly, relationship with that word. And I acknowledge that it is complicated for a lot of people. And I think one of the biggest flags that you described in what you just shared is the idea that it would be put on someone, told to do it, prescribed to do it. You need to do this in order to let it go. It's a word that conditions us to let people off the hook, to keep perpetuating the problem, to stuff it under the rug. And it's coupled against this other contrast in healing that where there's no guarantee of accountability or getting an apology. I could be waiting the rest of my life for an apology from my abusers. I'm never going to get one. So for me, forgiveness was, I mean, I grew up with hearing that you should forgive, and it was kind of synonymous with you should not hold a grudge. You should not continue to hold somebody to a harm that they've done, that you become bitter. I have a different take on bitterness today than I used to. To me, bitterness is the result of a feeling where you know a wrong was done and no action was taken. So when we are forced to forgive, but we see it continue, bitterness forms in our hearts because we know that's wrong. That's our call to justice, and we know it's wrong. So bitterness for me is a healing herb. It's going to fuel your fire to make something happen. It's our call to become advocates and outcry something like that, draw attention to it so that it can be addressed. Maybe not you're going to get the result that you think you want in pink pastels where everybody apologizes and hugs and kisses and all that. That is not something you bestow on somebody who doesn't deserve it. So I had let go. I just kind of put a bookmark in forgiveness for a long time, and I didn't want to touch that word. I certainly didn't feel like I owed it to anybody. I knew I wouldn't get it. But I came to understand forgiveness as more of a release after the wound had been addressed. So I can't always do something to hold my abuser accountable. But if I have just let them go and said, I forgive you, which in my case with my husband, my job was to help him feel forgiven so that he could become a successful man. That was the message I was told often. As long as I was holding on to resentments, I was holding him back. I learned that if I stuffed it and I issued that forgiveness because I was trying to be an obedient Christian, and I stuffed it down and I carried that wound in my body still, that is how it was going to start negatively impacting me. It's the injury that I carried in my body that was the problem. So that's what I had to deal with. When I've tended to my wounds and I've tended to the impacts that I've suffered as a result, and I have freely expressed whatever way I need to what happened, which for me, you know, like my book was a big step towards this, I was able to look at forgiveness more as a release. I free you from this. I free you from me. I free myself from you. I still don't use that language so much. I say I let it go because that's what I'm doing. I let it go. That I'm not going to allow it to, I put a boundary on it. I don't allow it to continue messing with my future. But it really isn't about the other person. That really is about me. And it can only be done when I've tended to the injury.
Interesting. And tending to the injury does mean giving it what? Respect?
Respect, air, light, visibility. I'm not hiding my wound so that someone else can feel more comfortable. I'm not going to deny that harm was done in order to keep a system afloat. I'm not going to keep it all in the family because it makes everyone else so much more comfortable when they do that, because that's self-betrayal. So once I did the work against self-betrayal, I realized I can't in good conscience take care of myself and my injury if I'm doing all of that for them. That is, again, slipping into the subservient role of their needs are higher than my needs, and I will self-harm in order to protect that. I don't do that anymore. Forgiveness is just one of those laden words that I just don't carry with me. I mean, sure, I might do some version of it, but I don't feel tied to that vocabulary anymore.
Okay. I think it's really cool. You know, when we think about that you have to do something to make someone else's life whatever, better, easier, get them off the hook, that does create, I think, resentment that grows over time. You might not even know the word for it. You can just feel it. And it can leak out in other ways, because I think emotions that are not addressed do find a way to leak out. And then it gets very messy. I find it so interesting. You hear not only in religious practice, but in Greek mythology, like the sirens, they're causing the sailors to crash their ships along the shore. Like these women, these female characters, Eve, I mean, going back to Adam and Eve, Pandora, all the chicks who are somehow holding men back or causing them problems. And it's all around us. And then if we need to forgive men, then what do the men have to do?
Nothing. Just keep going on. Just keep going on. And it gets right back into that service model where you're deferring and to sometimes very evil ends. That makes you complicit in ongoing harm. I don't want to be complicit in ongoing harm. I want to say, no, this is where the limit is. This stops here. I can't always, again, you know, I can't always stop an abuser or stop a system, but I can be vocal in where it stopped with me. And that's my side of the street. When I serenity prayer my problems between what I can change and what I can't, that's sometimes where the line lies. I can speak for myself and I can speak for other survivors. I can advocate on behalf of other survivors. I can't always change the bad guys, but I can make sure everybody knows what the bad guys did.
Oh, I love that. Right? Accountability. Back to accountability. Okay, yeah. So when we think about arriving on this planet, right? Like coming out of the spaceship has crashed in a field. And then you open the door and you're thinking, I don't know how to be in this world. I've often told families, loved ones who have been able to rescue their other loved ones who have been ensnared in a variety of different situations to hold off on throwing them a party quite yet, because they are so disoriented and overwhelmed and still unsure. And they need a moment, a lot of moments, actually. They might be so exhausted, or they might have been given such a hard time throughout the time that they were doubting and leaving, that now they're even more bruised coming out of it. And so I'm wondering if you can take us to even those first few days or weeks and what that was like for you during that time, what you needed, what was hard, etc.
Yeah, it's tender. It's so tender and so raw. And a good, I don't know, first third of the book deals with shock and aftermath, because for me, that's the territory I found myself in. And I found a lot of freedom comparing that period of time to physical shock, because the symptoms are so similar, but we don't recognize them the same in our life and in our culture. So making room for psychological shock, for the way my nervous system was absolutely frayed. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. I was shaking. I had a very hard time concentrating. Those are very somatic symptoms of something that was psychologically wounding. And yet I wasn't bleeding. I didn't have casts on my body. I was expected to parent, run my career, make major divorce decisions, continue in a faith that had just harmed me so greatly. No one expected me to run away from my church, run to my church, but that was very complicated. So, you know, I was very underweight. I wasn't sleeping. I was really, my anxiety was off the charts high. And we didn't have really in 2007, in my circles at least, we certainly didn't talk about anxiety by name and without shame. And so I was trying to keep up appearances and I was cracking and so vulnerable. And that's when people cult hop, and that's when they fall back into high control patterns, and that's when they're so vulnerable to people who want to exploit their labor and their problems. And I fell for all of that, which meant that I was in this shock and aftermath for about 4 years. That's pretty long to be still dealing and reeling. But I had never tended to those symptoms, so they continued and perpetuated. And I found myself, you know, in early therapy, learning how to set worry appointments and compartmentalize for the first time. Basic self-care, really, really basic self-care. Just the privilege of saying, I need a minute. I need to think about that before I give you an answer. That was very hard to self-assert. I felt so bad for not being able to perform on demand for people. It was a pretty catastrophic time. And for a while, the subtitle for this book was How to Predator-Proof Your Life. Because I really do believe that you're less vulnerable to predators if you can grow to a place where you have resilience, you have bandwidth, you have the ability to pace yourself, take a minute, set boundaries and restrictions and limits. You present as a stronger, more confident person. Predators don't want to mess with you because they know they can't. Your skill level's way up here. Just because you have the sovereignty to say, I need my time. I'm trying to get comfortable with that word, but that's exactly what it is. You're queen of your own life. And so you deem when someone else comes in for an audience. That's a completely different take than, you know, where I was in those early days where I felt enslaved by other people's demands. And I felt like I owed them my time and attention. And I didn't have anything to give them. I was so broken and so terrified of the world and overwhelmed by normal aspects of adult life. I was 33. I had 4 kids. That's what people saw. But I was really with the maturity and mindset of a much, much, much younger person in my older teens. I could run a household and make food and change diapers, but I didn't know how to balance a checkbook or do school paperwork or, you know, meet deadlines or any of the things that you would expect a 33-year-old to be able to handle. People would ask me, like, what do you like? And I couldn't even answer them because I had no idea. I had no idea where I wanted to eat for dinner or where I wanted to live or what I dreamt of for my life because I hadn't spent any time in my selfhood. Virtually had no selfhood. It was really kind of truncated around 14. And so I had to redevelop. And I didn't even know that was possible because the message was back then, like, you didn't develop. You're kind of stuck there. You're broken for life. And I didn't find that acceptable, but I didn't necessarily know there was an alternative.
Going to that phrase, I didn't find that acceptable. So it was interesting because as a therapist who works with people who have been involved in cults and very controlling systems of people who have been told who they are, they will say, I don't know who I am, and I don't know what I'm supposed to fill in the blank, believe in, do, what my purpose is, what my meaning is. Those moments have been hard because I think, well, I can try to help you, but I also don't want to define you. I want to be able to facilitate you becoming you, and who are you? One of the things that has been interesting to kind of land on to a certain degree is that sometimes you start by knowing who you're not, what you don't believe in, what you really sense is wrong and that you wouldn't ever do to anyone else. Like sometimes that's the place to begin to kind of craft. I picture someone who makes sculptures. They chip away and they create something by taking things away. So what would you never do? What do you not believe in? What always felt wrong to you? And then you start to form. That might be a place to begin.
I kind of did. I mean, I have not really used that language, but it was subtractive in the beginning. You're absolutely right. I was like, I know where I don't want to go. I know what I don't want to do. Don't force me back down that road. But I didn't have much of a leg to stand on, you know. I couldn't defend myself that way. I couldn't explain why. That's why language was so important to me. There's a lot of etymology in I Belong to Me because I had to learn those words. I didn't know those words. We had this editorial conversation too because we live in a time where people can just Google a word that they don't know. But I was like, they're not going to stop reading the book to go do that. I want it in the text so they can see this is what this is. And that is coming alongside me through the experience. But I had no vision yet for what the future was going to hold. I just knew what it wouldn't. And you're right. That is a starting place.
Like, I'm not going to repeat that again, or I'm not going to let someone do that to me again.
Exactly. That's empowering. It's like you've at least taken some options off the table.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And to be able to learn to say no. I mean, even what you're saying is maybe, or I'm not sure, is even hard. So to get to know, woo.
Yeah, the number one word of consent. Like I didn't have any consent at all in my marriage. So learning to say no was scary. And I was terrified of retribution. And then I realized, actually, the world, they expect you to be able to say no. There was a lot of like instruction in the Christian world of teaching women how to say no. It was coupled with, we had a period of time where there were a lot of books saying you're enough. You are more than enough. And I was like, well, they're combating that message for a reason. Let me spend some time there, you know? But they do expect adults to be able to say yes and no, and I didn't. And so that was part of becoming an adult late in life. A well-trained wife is a coming-of-age journey, even though, you know, I'm not in puberty. I was in my 30s.
Right. It's funny, even with kids, you hear them talking about how when their parent says maybe, they hear it as no. There's some parents who don't feel comfortable saying an absolute no, but still kids learn how to interpret what it really means. And I'm wondering also for you as a parent, for you to share as much or as little as you feel comfortable, because I want to preserve their privacy and your family's privacy. But just going through these changes of becoming while tending to and guiding others in the world, that's quite a challenge.
It was, and I will count it as an injury of my life that I cannot ever get back, that I was becoming an adult and growing and healing through my children's high school years and teenage years, and I don't ever get that back. They deserved a healed, actualized adult parent, and they really didn't get one. They got a mom who was growing, who was very committed to that growth, and that's got its own strengths, got its own benefits, but I would have loved to have been a healed parent for them. That would have been a great gift. They deserved that. But to the healing, I often found it easier to give my kids what I didn't think I deserved myself or didn't know how to give myself. So I did give my children language of consent from a very young age. They were raised from infancy, basically, that if I ask you a question, you're allowed to say no to it. If I can't let you say no to it and it's a command, then I will frame it as a command. So I was teaching them from the beginning that a question mark implies you have agency to say no. I wouldn't even know how to say that sentence, and I was doing that, you know? But my kids grew up knowing that if mom's asking, it's okay to say no to me, and there's no consequence for that. I've asked you an open question, you know? So that was an example of something that I gave them that I was years from giving myself the same permission, the same blessing. I stopped spanking them, you know, years before I, even I was stopped, you know, spanked after I was no longer disciplined in my marriage and abused in my marriage. I raised them pretty much the polar opposite of fundamentalism as I was unpacking fundamentalism. Like that whole answer of like what we're not going to do again, I applied to parenting before I really understood what the language of what I was doing, giving them a broader worldview. I didn't know to call it that, but I made sure they had a broader worldview, that they had diverse experiences and that they celebrated diversity and had a curiosity about the world. It's wonderful. I mean, motherhood is a lot of what saved me, because it gave me such a, well, I love them so much. And I only wanted to pour life into them. I didn't want to repeat cycles and mistakes. And sometimes I was bearing the brunt of the mistake I had made, but I wanted to shield them from it. So I would parent them differently than I was living with.
It's very powerful to hear that, that while you were still dealing with corporal punishment, you had stopped it for your children. Wow. That kind of gives me the chills, that you knew inherently what was right or wrong for people in this world, but you, I think, felt that you still needed to endure it or weren't ready to leave it or say no to it.
I really had no choice. It was either leave or do it. And by doing it, which the reason why corporal punishment came into my marriage was a way to handle violence, erratic violence. He thought it would help him channel his aggression and answer to God for my behavior. And so if I complied with it, I could shield them from his violence. So it was very transactional. I will do this. I will take this so that you don't unleash it elsewhere. And it was leaving that made that all stop. And then that was the destruction of my family. That was the end of my family. So it was pretty high stakes. There was no negotiating or saying no to that. That was not really going to happen.
It's so interesting because it's reminding me of what they often will say about manipulators and narcissists, that the story gets started in the middle. And what I mean by that is it doesn't matter what they do to you. It matters how you respond to it, and that you're then the reason that things are bad or that whatever, they get upset. So he could, I don't know him, so I'm speaking about him just as this abstract, but that he could have this anger management issue and unleash it on you. It was then your responsibility to take it to protect the kids, starting the story there, as opposed to, why doesn't he learn to not hit anybody and to really know that that's wrong in general and to diffuse his own internal bomb so that he doesn't have to do it on other people?
Yeah. The bigger answer to that is patriarchy. When you're in a world like Doug Wilson's world, which is where we were, where he's telling you the man is the king of the home, this is his fiefdom, what he says goes, and then that's coupled with doctrines that teach if a man asks a woman to sin, she should still obey him because it's her obedience that will change his heart. It's her obedience that she'll save her husband. He's not going to ever be challenged in his behavior. It's going to be blessed because he's the man, and you don't question men and you don't question God. And so these things just are allowed to keep going, just perpetuate. And he's never challenged. He's never corrected. And we weren't allowed to go to doctors or get medication or anything like that. Couldn't see psychiatrists or anything. He would have very much, he has bipolar and borderline personality disorder, and he would have benefited from intervention, but we weren't allowed to go do that. We had to depend on God. And God said it was okay to do this.
Okay. There are a lot of women and some men as well who I've talked to. This isn't just for women, but mainly women who I've worked with who were made to feel like they needed to marry someone or stay with someone because their nature would help to balance out the other person's nature, that they would somehow fix them, cure them, etc. And that doesn't happen. Period. The end. It's such a trap. Such a trap. Because if it doesn't work, then what? Then you are seen as someone who is not doing it enough.
Yeah. You're stuck.
Yeah, right.
You're stuck. You're responsible. You didn't submit well enough. You aren't praying hard enough. This is your lot in life. It's all on your shoulders and you have no way to leave. I really did believe that death was preferable to divorce, because divorce is so shamed. And the scriptures that you're tossing, you know, like a quiet answer turns away wrath. Well, if you would be more silent, then he wouldn't be so angry. You know, it's those kind of statements.
Right. Like if you get dinner on the table on time, then he won't have to hurt you.
Right. Exactly.
Those things should be not connected ever.
Should's the devil. Yeah.
Okay. Right. There you go. But just that there's this causal relationship that's just manufactured. No, one thing is not because of the other thing, but it becomes a very convenient out. It seems like your life was filled with men having these convenient outs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a man's world. That was the encapsulation, which means my humanity, there's no room for my humanity or my individuality or my needs or my even the strengths that I bring to something. I am a high capacity person. I could have carried so much more in my marriage. I could have been the breadwinner. There's so many things I could have done, but I wasn't allowed to be in my power. And so I had to diminish it. And when you diminish it, everyone suffers. I was not performing, you know, to my best capability because that wasn't wanted. And so I think patriarchy does a huge disservice to men and women. I think it increases the load that men have to carry when they have to look at their dependent, their wife as another dependent. No one is at their full potential bringing their strengths as a team partnership to the table. You're picking and choosing, or you're choosing chores according to gender. Only women with a vagina can wash dishes because your vagina actually helps you wash dishes? Oh, no. But God said you have different roles. Yeah, it doesn't really make for a better marriage or a better union.
But I'm glad you brought that up about how patriarchy does a disservice to men as well. It really does. It's very handicapping, and it limits being able to really develop also, I think, into full-fledged adults in this world who can take responsibility and accountability and learn to do things on their own and not just reassign or assign blame outward so that they don't have to see what part they played. And just the vision that they have of women and how it's okay to treat women or how it's okay to treat children. There was a woman I know, she's a psychiatrist, and she flies to different places where there is a lot of part of the culture, there's a lot of prostitution. And she goes to places like Thailand and others. And it's her job, actually. She's developed this area specialization of teaching the men that women are human beings. And she didn't realize it needed to be that basic because she would just teach them about women's rights, that it's not okay. But she realized it was actually a core issue of they are human beings. And that sometimes she will say to the man, do you have a sister? Do you have a mother? Do you see them as human beings? Oh, of course. But anyone who is not in their family system and who is female is not necessarily at the same level in terms of humanity. And so she's needed to say, think of all women as your sister and your mother. And it is core. But it can be retrained if people are open to it, if they want to not be that way in the world and not be that man in the world, and that it is possible. It's harder, I think, when you have different psychiatric issues that might get in the way or that you feel like this system works for you.
Right. No, I love how you put that when you were describing that, because they're not actualized healthy adults either. And so it's all of us doing our work to get there. But to your point, the system already benefits them and they have other hurdles to have to climb. What's their motivation? Why should they? I would argue you should, because you'll be happier, healthier, and you'll quit getting your junk all over everyone else. But they got to value that. They got to want to not do any harm and to stop these cycles.
And I think reevaluating what it means to be strong and what it means to have power, that power isn't, I think, it isn't just standing on people's backs to raise yourself up. It really is standing on your own feet and having a powerful stance about things. And it also, that control, I think, that ultimate control is self-control. This is much harder, I think, to have self-control than to take control of someone else. But those ideas are not fostered. It's like the parent who will never apologize because, oh, I'm not going to give over that power. But they don't realize how empowering that is and how it comes from this really wonderful, confident place, where you can say to your child or to your wife or to anyone, I'm so sorry. You're right. I really made a mistake and I won't do it again. And people really see you as courageous and powerful, not weak. But I think men, unfortunately, to a great degree, are taught that they're going to be rescinding something if they step up and take responsibility.
I love that because it brings us back to forgiveness. It's something I bestow on you. It is a power move to be able to forgive someone. But you can't do it from a broken place.
Right. Going back to the idea of forgiveness. And then I want to make sure to give you a chance to talk about things that you would impart on the listeners. But Was there more that you wanted to say about this idea of forgiveness?
I love what you said about power and the confidence that it takes. When we started talking about forgiveness in the beginning, it's this idea that it's put upon you. It's an insult to your injury. It's one more thing you owe your perpetrator, your perpetuator. And it's often pulled and elicited from someone versus when you are granting it from a place of power as a royal sovereign of your own life. It is no sweat. Whatever, that's behind me. If you need that, go ahead. I give this to you. I give you freedom. It's a completely different way to conduct your life. When I had that moment, I felt like I had really turned the corner on my character arc. I was a different person. I was no longer walking wounded, no longer in my victimhood. I was in that confident place of power. I understood what was a threat and what was not a threat. It was no longer a threat to forgive someone. And I only grant that to people who deserve it. I don't give it to people who haven't done their work. There have been times I have forgiven or bestowed that freedom on people who I choose not to have present in my life anymore. That means I'm not going to think about them. I'm not going to be enslaved to the things that they want me to think about. They are irrelevant to me. They are no longer empowered over me. And so I sever the ties. And so it's totally a power move, and I love it. But I also am careful and judicious how I use it because it's complicated in our culture and triggers abound, especially in the religious trauma landscape.
Oh, absolutely right. So I think when we talk even just the word bestow, it gives the impression, I think, in a very appropriate way that these are gifts. You don't want to have to feel forced to give someone forgiveness, to give someone love, to give someone honor, to give someone respect.
Yeah, or a hug.
Or a hug, yes. Yeah, I remember when I was little, I was told I was hurting people's feelings if I didn't hug them, and I didn't want to hug everyone. I was uncomfortable with that. But no, you'll make them upset. Or look how sad she looks that you're not giving her a hug. And I was, yeah, you learn early on, I'm responsible to sacrifice my body, my personal space to make someone else happy.
Right. And that can stay with you for a lifetime.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. What is another point or two that you want to make sure to mention before we finish up?
Malong is a vulnerable book to put out into the universe. My sex chapter is not like anybody else's sex chapter. It is about voice and embodiment and power. If you're familiar with Fundy Baby voice and the way that impacts you, I really get into that in the sex chapter. There are topics in here that are different than other healing books, but I hope that it's the kind of book that people come back to again and again. I'll say that the audiobook for A Well-Trained Wife, because it's a compelling narrative, people loved the audio and they clung to it, and it outsells the hardcover by 3-1. However, I expect it will be the opposite for this one, because this is a book you want to touch the topics, hold the topics, and then reflect on your own experiences. It won't carry you. I mean, it is a compelling story still, and the audio is beautiful. But if you're somebody who likes to stop with a skill and hold it and work through it, it's created that way and crafted that way. And so the hardcover might be more beneficial to you on the long term. It's not a blow through it kind of a book. And it's also written in a way that will apply to anyone coming from any kind of high control dynamic, not just religious trauma. So if you have generational issues or toxic relationships, narcissistic top, that kind of thing, you will find merit in it. So I'm hopeful people will take it to their therapists. I know that so many therapists are trying to become more religious trauma informed. That's what this book is. It's there to empower people going through the experience. So I hope that's how it lands.
I love that idea also that it is available in other ways. There are a lot of people coming out of situations where they feel overwhelmed and that it's hard for them to read. It's hard for them to focus. There's nothing wrong with you. Your mind
right.
is overwhelmed. It's okay. And if you need to listen, fine. And if you're doing fine with reading, and then take your time, it's not going to be on the homework. It's yours. It's your gift to others to take, and they can take their time with it. I love the way you speak. I love the way you write. It's very thoughtful, and it's so important just also talking about how we talk and how we talk about this and the language that's used and how much it influences us and how we get to, we don't have to call ourselves sensitive anymore. And all the words that have other connotations that we don't just have to jump into those identities because those were terms that used to be used. So I love being able to craft your own language around this, which is really wonderful and personal. And so it's always a treat and a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope we get to do it again.
Yes. Well, book three sold. There's a good chance for that.
Okay. So yeah, we'll be talking again. Very exciting. Very exciting. Great to see you.
You too.
One more thing before you go. Thank you to Tia. Tia is a very special guest. Tia is a very special person, someone who knows how to put things in a way that is so heartfelt and also so clear. And I love speaking with her, and I love also how she is open and also does a lot of teaching about ways to think about these sorts of issues and also ways to construct language around it to understand it. There is something that I wanted to come back to in my conversation with her that, well, many things that I thought were interesting. One was this whole part about how other people are held accountable for what their abusers and controllers do and feel. So that, for example, if Tia or anyone or the women in the group were holding on to resentments about anything, about how they were being treated, and resentments that I think are well-founded and appropriate, then that emotion, that again, is a natural outcome of being mistreated, somehow was holding her husband back, or it's holding the other men in the group back from achieving their goals. It's like the narcissist's way of doing things, the vulnerable narcissist, the covert narcissist. I didn't get that job promotion because someone had it out for me, or I wasn't seen as the most compelling speaker in the room because someone else used some sort of strange technique to get people to be under their spell, and they weren't being honest in the way they were presenting things, and that's the only reason people like them more. Whatever it is, as small or as big as it is, still, it can never be their fault. And that doesn't mean that all the people in these situations who blame others have narcissistic personality disorder, but there's something about a fundamentalist system that can cause people to behave that way, like they have narcissistic tendencies, like they are just not people who are going to be having to take any accountability. But it doesn't come sometimes from within them like it does from a narcissistic personality. It comes from the system around them that encourages them to look at situations that way. And the problem, of course, is that then the person who's being blamed, namely in this situation, Tia and other women in the group, are going to take that on and think, oh, it is my fault. I need to work harder on not having any kind of negative emotional reaction to being mistreated, which makes you more vulnerable to being mistreated and feeling like you'd somehow deserve it, but also that it can make you feel like somehow you are the one who has to keep changing. You're the one who has to keep morphing into something else and betraying yourself and your own reactions in order to help the people around you. The other thing that it does do too is it makes those in that power position atrophy emotionally and atrophy developmentally. Because if you just can constantly blame someone else and get away with it, when do you learn to step up and take responsibility? When do you learn to have the courage, the bravery, the maturity to say, oh yeah, that makes sense that my wife is feeling resentment about X, Y, and Z. I probably should not have done that to her, or I shouldn't have allowed such and such to happen to her or been fine with it. And so there are people who really need to work on themselves, becoming adults in the world, having that kind of adult demeanor and way of looking at things that matches their chronological age, because that is a work in progress, not only for women leaving these situations, but for the men. There is this other question that I want to make sure to highlight before finishing up this one more thing before you go for you, which is this question that Tia posed, which is an important question to ask yourself. Who benefits when I have no self? It's a fantastic question. And you can fill in the end of that question with a lot of different things. Who benefits when I, whatever it is, who benefits when I don't question anymore? Who benefits when I stay, even though I'm being abused or neglected, mistreated, abandoned in so many ways? Who benefits from my silence? Who benefits from me going along? Who benefits from me having a smile on my face all the time, even though inside I'm suffering? Who benefits from me forgiving them all the time, even though they're the ones who are wronging me? And who benefits from me making it okay for them to do this? And sometimes it is the person in direct contact with you who does these things to you who benefits. And sometimes it's the leader of the organization who benefits because it maintains the status quo, it maintains the hierarchy, keeps things in that kind of safe balance, even though it's out of balance. But the balance for them is that certain people are superior and others are inferior, and certain people are submissive and certain people are going to be dominant. And that's the balance. And that if you behave the way you're supposed to, then it maintains the status quo. And part of, I think, Tia talking about all of this is to have people notice not only what they're being taught to do and what they're being taught to not do, but to ask that question, who am I doing this for? Who benefits? Always an important thing. Because after a while, you want it to be you who benefits. And if you're not benefiting from any of that, then it's time to rethink your devotion to it. And it's time to rethink staying there. And I know that's a huge decision and a hard decision, but a very important one. Take good care, and I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
Are you healing from manipulation, narcissistic abuse, or coercive control? I created something for you. It's called the Restore Journal app. Built from my decades of experience helping survivors recover, this trauma-informed app is more than journaling. It's a guided healing space to help you process what happened, reconnect with your voice, rebuild self-trust, and create healthier boundaries for the future. You can move at your own pace through all of the sections. And it's a multimedia healing support designed for different learning styles and needs. There are 3 tiers, including one that offers you full access to my video and audio library. If you're ready to feel understood, supported, and move forward with more clarity and strength, the link for the app is in the show notes. Take good care.